My name is Jeff Towns, and I'm a volunteer staff here. And my background is in environmental studies. And so when I noticed this book, both in the Holden News, the spring edition, and also on reserve reading here in the library, I was very much interested and bought the book. It's also in the bookstore. And I asked Charlie Mays, well, is someone giving a talk on it? And he kind of scratched his head, and he said, well, I guess not. I said, well, I'll volunteer. I haven't read this thing cover to cover, but I've kind of browsed through it. And this morning, the title of the book is called Earthkeeping. And so what I'm talking about this morning is a little bit of a book study on this, to kind of introduce to you the ideas found in this book, and also to cover some historical background and contemporary ideas in the issues concerning environmental ethics. This book I found really puts together many ideas and thoughts in a number of books. And this book is edited by Lauren Wilkinson and is written by a number of professors and I guess graduate students too, in a variety of fields. There are economists, theologians, historians, philosophers, and probably a few others in here. It is broken up into four sections, and the first one is known as the state of the planet. It gives you a background and perspective of what's happening in this world, particularly in terms of resources, population, in those areas. Very similar to the Global 2000 report, which was another talk I gave about a week ago. It's just an introduction to the Global 2000 report to the president, which covered to the year 2000 trends in resources and population statistics. The second section in here is called the Earthlings, and it's a description of how our attitudes toward nature and each other have been shaped. So it's the historical background to environmentalism and nature. Section 3 is called The Earth is the Lord's. And it's an attempt to evaluate our modern ideas and activities in terms of, or in light of, biblical principles. And then it follows up very nicely with how these principles place our many actions and attitudes and how that might be redeemed. So section 4 is called What Shall We Do? It's more of a practical guide. It not only lists specifics, but also lists in general terms what we might be able to do under these biblical principles. I won't go over that first section very much, or perhaps not even at all. It's, like I say, it kind of covers a lot of ground that the Global 2000 report covers, and I encourage you to just take a look at Volume 1 of the Global 2000 in the bookstore, or you can buy it in the bookstore or in the library. And in the front of it is just two or three pages which lists, it's a condensation of Volume 1, which is the conclusions that are reached, so it's a conclusions of conclusions, and it's a very good introduction. It kind of overwhelms you with statistics, but it's a good section to read on how our population has been growing and how they predict it will continue to grow, and how that population, both in absolute numbers and densities, will affect our use of resources, how it has and how it will. But under the theme of the program this summer, Living the Politics of Hope, I think it's best expressed very tersely by a scientist humanist by the name of René Dubos, or Dubos, excuse me, in just four words: trend is not destiny. So there is hope for the future in that these projections of the Global 2000, the projections and this rather despairing look at the state of the planet in this book, Earthkeeping, can be muted, can be altered by changes in policies, by changes particularly in attitudes, not only of politicians and leaders around the world, but also each of us individually. So zooming right along to the second section, boy, we just covered about 80 pages there, real quick. It's called The Earthlings, the Historical Roots and Our Mind Today, kind of subparts of section two in Earthkeeping. The writers of this book kind of go over how Greek thought, Platonism, Aristotle and his followers, the Stoics, Epicureans, a number of them, have led into our current thought, particularly Western thought, on the environment and on nature. And it's a rather schizophrenic one in that a couple of these, Platonism and Epicureanism, well, Epicureanism is kind of off in the boonies and really doesn't affect us that much, but Platonism particularly was an idea that of very much man against nature, being separate, dominion over, whereas the Aristotelian view and the Stoics almost revered nature as some place where one that was in tune with nature was good. The mind and the soul and the body in tune with nature was viewed of as being good and right and better for the human being. I am most familiar particularly with the beginnings and some of the background of particularly the American experience. And so maybe I'll just talk a little bit about that. And that includes a little bit of the Western thought as developed by the Greeks and the Romans. So we can't divorce ourselves from that completely in talking about it. Some have put the blame to our current environmental crisis and degradation of environment and resources in particular. One of these was a Zen Buddhist by the name of Daisetsu Suzuki in 1950, but it was really brought to the forefront in 1967 by Lynn White in an article in Science in 1967 called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. It's widely reprinted and quite well known. In that, White says that the exploitation of land was particularly a result of Christian values through out the world, and particularly in Europe. And this degradation, destruction of plants, the tilling of the soil, the cutting down of trees, the degradation of resources, if not particularly exploited by Christians and Christian views, was certainly supported by it. That view is not really particular to the Judeo-Christian background, because when you look at other cultures, for instance, the Buddhists contributed to the deforestation of Asia, cutting down the trees to help build their temples. So the impacts on the land through overgrazing, through cutting of forests, is not particular just to the Judeo-Christian background. In the early 1800s, well, let's go back a little bit earlier, the early 1700s, the founding fathers of this nation, nature was really viewed as an obstacle rather than an asset. If you can imagine the, say, Plymouth Bay Colony trying to eke out an existence, a survival in this land, the chaoticness, the massive the chaos, it almost was viewed as evil. The Indians, the harshness of the winters, and so nature was really seen as something to overcome for one's survival. Even in America, there's some schizophrenia as far as how nature is viewed, because from 1700s to say the late 1800s was a time of disposition in land policy, the expansion westward, the settlement of lands through governmental support of was it squatting or staying on a land for a certain amount of period, and then that land becomes yours. In the 1800s also was the birth of transcendentalism, right? Particularly Thoreau and Emerson, where nature was seen as a place to escape from civilization and its toils and tribulations. So here we have a reverence of nature and a fear of nature, something to overcome. This continued into right around the turn of the century, from about 1891 to 1910. Land was a period of preservation in the land, and that vast amounts of forest lands were preserved at this time. This was the Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt era. Gifford Pinchot was the Secretary of Agriculture, or the forestry arm under Teddy Roosevelt. And even then, there was rather bipolar fight going on between those of the utilitarian view of preserving nature for the wise use was termed as the best use, the greatest use for the greatest number of people. And actually a follower of Thoreau was John Muir out on the West Coast. He had wanted to preserve nature as inviolate sanctuaries of the human spirit. And so here was this extreme preservationist view to set aside land on its own qualities, and the government setting aside lands for the utilitarian view of greatest use for greatest number of people. That was kind of closed down after about 1910. 1911, something called the Weeks Act, where money, a fund was raised, and the question was whether the best use of that funds would have been for greater acquisitions of land to preserve and enforce in the national parks, or to just use the lands for certain inholdings in the areas that they've already gotten. And it really strikes me as something that sounds very familiar today, particularly with this administration. Before going on to that kind of covered the three conservation or environmental movements or land disposition movements, disposition, preservation, and then management after 1910. There are also some environmental movements or conservation movements called Conservation 1, 2, and 3. The first one starting with the Teddy Roosevelt era in the early 1900s. The second one being with FDR in the 1930s and 40s. And then the third conservation movement starting in the late 1960s, as you know. I'll kind of come back to that and what the implications of that is for our views on nature and the environment today. Going back to the exploitation of nature and how this view got developed, an oft-quoted scriptural basis for this was way back in Genesis 1, 128, where it says, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, and every living thing that moves upon the earth." Somewhere along the line, dominion, the word dominion, the word rule, subdue, in Western culture got to be greatly misconstrued, very much twisted. You wonder why the exploitation of nature, regardless of its consequences, is an excuse for Christians. The dominion theory, though, does not really take into account the full biblical message, which speaks of responsibility, respect, love, and stewardship for nature. Having dominion over nature does not permit us to exploit and destroy it and abuse it in tyranny. Even so, in the second account of creation, in Genesis 2, it's a completely different terminology in that man was placed in the garden to till it and keep it. And that's in Genesis 2:15. So there you have more of a husbanding effect of nature. The Garden of Eden was not so much a garden such as in your back, your own backyard where you grow cauliflower, carrots, and chrysanthemums or something, but it was a term used to pretty much describe all of nature, both the earth, the water, the air, the plants and animals, and humans. Adam himself in the creation is created from the earth, and so mankind cannot really separate itself out from nature, though we have some supernatural qualities that God has given to us. We are not divorced from the quality of nature from which we have sprung up. Even before that, the creation story describes how God creates the earth and some of the animals in it, the air, the water, the firmaments of heaven. And after each one, it describes how God saw it was good. Not said it was good, but saw that it was good. So nature in itself, though created by God, is separate from God. But it also has the affirmation that nature in and of itself has meaning, and apart from the human rightness and wrongness that we give to it, it takes away that anthropocentric view of nature, that it is for the use of man, for man to have dominion over it. When I say man, it's the inclusive word. And so our dominion of it is really God's dominion and our keeping, tilling, and caring of it. A little bit earlier I mentioned this man against nature bastardization of the word dominion in our care for nature. In the time of Christ and the Hebrew culture, their neighbors worshipped a god named Baal. It was a god of nature. It was a lot of the worship at that time was pagan animism, revering animals as gods and things. Life was also viewed as cyclical. You could pretty much predict the future on the past. So in the Judeo-Christian, the challenge of the Judeo-Christian view was God acting in history. It's always a progress through time in where the future could not be predicted, could not be demonstrated. And so often an escape to these other religions was an escape from God's acting in history. It seems very similar to the transcendentalism of Muir and of Thoreau and Emerson and Muir also, in that you're escaping humanity as God puts us into it. On the secular level, three revolutions support the idea of man against nature. The agricultural revolution had a great impact. The advent of the 8-oxen plow to be able to till the land had a profound effect on the use of land. Then democratization led to the redistribution and the reallocation of goods and resources as they were developed from agriculture. And then the third is industrialization, which blended natural science and technology. And what this led to was a great divergence in the capital to land ratio, greatly increased. It led to greater demand for goods and services, and it resulted and continues to result in more refuse, and especially in the densely populated areas, the industrialized and urban centers. Again, the settling of this nation was odds with nature. So it was, again, man against nature. Even in the expansion westward, it was till until the land could no longer produce and then move on. And so you left a mess behind you. Even today, an invisible religion is kind of celebrated in America that some have called scientism. It seems that we have an implicit faith in technique, in the technical skill to solve all our problems. But a person by the name of Lewis Moncrief said, it's one thing to appreciate the value of technology, but it's something else entirely to view it as our environmental savior, something that will save us in spite of ourselves. This idea still pervades the environmental education field today. Some of you may have heard of the term spaceship Earth. It was kind of brought about in the early 60s when the flights out into space sent back this color picture of this blue planet of ours, and how much it almost was like the spaceship that went out with a couple of people in it, so that the Earth was a contained entity. Resources were finite. It was first brought up by Barbara Ward, but really expressed by Ken Boulding in his book called The Economics of Coming Spaceship Earth. Even so, this idea is still a man against nature. It's the ecosystem, the stability of it, is still controlled by man. Whatever we mess up, we try and clean up. Whatever we disturb, we attempt to stabilize. But it's like a house of cards where you may prop it up with toothpicks or something to kind of stabilize it. The problem is, if you take out one of the bottom cans or the bottom cards or the bottom toothpicks, it can all come tumbling down. We seem to be messing into an area that is very complex, and if we don't happen to put the right props in the right places in the right order and support these continuously, we can really end up in a great environmental disaster. And we even see some effects of this even now. What this earthkeeping expresses, and a few recent authors have called, is something referred to as, well, they call it earthkeeping. Another word for it, if I can find it, is earthmanship, where it is an idea of man and nature, where we are not separated from it, yet a part of it. We do have some care for it, some ruling over it, but it's one where it's kind of a selective control here and there, but basically letting nature run on its own. It's based on an ecological understanding and an ethic of creative stewardship. Earthmanship recognizes the necessity for freedom and diversity, novelty and spontaneity, grandeur and humility. Earthkeeping and earthmanship don't call for the subordination of human welfare to the preservation of nature, which some critics like to level at it, but rather as Lytton Caldwell says, a defense of earthbound people against our own inadvertent self-destruction through ecocide. Big words in there. Perhaps our antiquated American values might be replaced by new ethical guidelines. Going back to this book, Earthkeeping, edited by Lauren Wilkinson, we've gone through the state of the planet rather quickly, the Earthlings and how society has evolved in our current way of thinking. Into section 3, the Earth is the Lord's. The view of man against nature, the misinterpretation of dominion is one of the earliest heresies, was divorce nature and God, nature and supernature. When we corrupt nature and distort it, nature being a symbol of God's grace, then the Creator God becomes somewhat of a different substance and is separated from the Redeemer God of the New Testament. Quite often when we talk about the theological understanding of environmental ethics, they often tend just to quote the Old Testament, and very little of the message of the New Testament comes through. That of the redeeming qualities of man, there is hope for us to change our own attitudes, the attitudes and structures of the government that serves over us. I'm not sure where else to go from here except to mention the last section. It's really nice in that with all of this background, it kind of gives a what shall we do, kind of a practical guideline. Maybe I'll just read a few of these just to give you an idea of what they call guideposts that are offered in this book, Earthkeeping. Number 1, the exercise of power inherent in our dominion must be rooted in knowledge, wisdom, and wonder. Number 2, the demands placed on stewards by both the human population and the ecosphere are complementary. They're not at odds to one another. They can be in union, can be complementary. It also mentions, the first one particularly, that it's not really a man against nature, man over nature. Not necessarily preserving nature over and above human welfare, and to think of it only in theological light, but also that the science, ecology, the study of our household of Earth is actually a blessing of God, that we can find out more of God's grace through these secular studies. Number 3 is, we have the responsibility to work toward a just distribution of all energy and mineral resources. Here we're getting into more specifics, talking about, it reflects a resolution in the United Nations in 1974 for a new economic, international economic society. 4, we have the responsibility to provide for future generations and at least the same opportunities for resource use that we inherited from earlier generations. And we should not impose on future generations any responsibilities greater than those which prior generations have left us. That last point is a much debated argument now, particularly in the storage of nuclear waste. also in land use planning, how we plan both our resources and our agriculture and other land uses, not just for a short-term economic gain, but also for future generations, a longer planning horizon. And that was point number five. The time horizon for long-term planning must be very broad. Just skipping. No process of agriculture, mining, transportation, energy generation, waste disposal, recreation, and so forth should take place until its consequences for the household of life should have been established. And it has a really nice quote from Aldo Leopold from the Sand County Almanac. A thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. Point nine, concern for the consequences of our actions have on the ecosphere must include consideration of the other creatures with whom we share the earth and its resources. Relating it back to Genesis 1, God created the earth and the animals and saw that it was good. Apart from our human seeing that it is good. Perhaps the best thing I can do is leave you with a greater confidence that I can ever give you, and especially after I'm gone. Perhaps a little bibliography, a few books that you might go to that I have found very helpful. I think this earthkeeping is an excellent study because it does mix the theological with what's happening, with how our ideas have been developed, and also with some specific suggestions. Another would be Aldo Leopold, the Sand County Almanac. It's just a beautiful collection of his, it's almost a journal style, and the last few chapters in the book talk about a new land ethic, and it's really the first inklings in America of a different kind of man and nature, a new conservation, a new environmental ethic. A Sand County Almanac. I think Sand County is in Wisconsin, that's where his farm was. Some heavier readings would be those by René Dubos, even Teilhard de Chardin, which we talked about here in community, Holden community. Lauren Isley has a few things. Get a hold of that small article by Lynn White, The Historical Roots of Our Environmental Crisis. Any questions? Are there any particular areas that you'd like me to elaborate on?
Well, without getting into politics, how does Watts go along in your thoughts?
Pardon me, how does Watt?
Yeah, the Secretary of Interior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's been quite a back and forth between the people.
Yes. My personal view is he has, in the directives of the Department of the Interior and the Department of Agriculture, the directives say for a multiple use aspect. But also there is that element of care and of preserving for future generations, which is also actually kind of the motto, the directive of the National Park System, which is under Watt in the Department of the Interior. He says that for so long the pendulum has swung to the environmentalists, the preservationists. What gets seen is the Environmental Defense Fund, the Sierra Club, in the courts, this kind of action, which is very confrontive. Whereas I think the majority of environmentalists, a lot of polls say that Americans in general, a vast majority of them, continue to support our current controls of clean air and clean water and do not want to see them relax. I think there's an environmental consciousness that is not as confrontive and political as some of these other. Needless to say, Watt seems to think that he just wants to kind of center the pendulum as far as use. I think he's swung a bit toward the utilitarian view of our lands and our resources, to use the resources for the economic status of this country, and particularly through large extractive companies. My personal opinion is that while he says the pendulum was swung toward the center, I think it swung quite a bit to the right as far as the extraction of minerals from lands that I think can be cared for, preserved, and not so easily extracted out of this earth before its complete implications are really thought out.
Like I was reading that day, the question and answer, he figured that they should go in and locate a lot of minerals and everything, and then unless the war come up, something where they really needed it bad, try to leave it alone, but at least get it located.
The problem with that is there would be a tendency from in this pluralistic society for a strongly political interest group to say, you know, to really see these cookies are out there and they just drool over them, and perhaps eventually they may have enough political swing to say, well, we know they're out there and resources are getting more and more scarce, so they probably would not wait for a war before they got something changed to go in and extract these resources.
Did you think you had things set up just right? Mm-hmm. Something else almost comes in. Quite a bone of contention with him. Mm-hmm. And the Sierra probably would think that.
Yeah, I have a couple of thoughts that maybe I could express here. One of them is, you referred so much to a man against nature. Mm-hmm. That is literally true. We have been so blessed in this country that we don't recognize that struggle. I very clearly remember hearing my forebears talking about the tough conditions in the old country. And it was literally a struggle for food, a day-to-day, meal-to-meal.
Yes.
This has been brought home to me by the fact that several years ago I had a secretary who married a fellow from Tanzania. She went back to live there. A few years later, we had a letter from her. She remembered that I had made a little solar stove, a stove for cooking with the sun. She asked if she could get the blueprint for making that, because this was a body in sand so high that we can't afford to buy it anymore, and now all our wood is gone. That is man against nature. in one thing. We don't even understand it in this country. People have no concept of what's involved in getting food to the grocery store. Literally, I'm serious about that. They have no concept of it.
Yes.
So it is man against nature. Now, there is the aspect of it that we must use the best knowledge we have to manage our resources. There are getting to be so many of us people in the world that more and more we are extending our extractive industries, agriculture, mining, whatever, to survive. We don't know that. We don't understand it. We don't feel it here in this country. But on a worldwide basis, that's the direction we're moving in. There are some pretty good estimates that would tell us that if we people were going to live and be part of nature without disturbing nature, in other words, dig a few roots, eat berries, and catch a few animals and eat them and so on. And by the way, even that is disturbing the environment. But without any agriculture, without the use of resources as we think of it now, this country, the USA, could probably support on the order of 2 to 5 million people. We are presently supporting 230 million people plus a lot of other people. So this is where technology has come in. It has done that. Now, getting to my second point, in dealing with the people who write and express their views like this, I have belonged to the Sierra Club. I like the outdoors. I like many of the things that the Sierra Club does. But I also see a tremendous amount of hypocrisy in that group. For example, these Sierra Club members, and I was one of them, I like to go backpacking. And I sure like that very light aluminum or magnesium alloy backpack with the light nylon cover on it, with the freeze-dried food, all this sort of thing, which is amongst the highest technology we have today. And I remember one of my friends who is a Sierra Club member has a four-wheel Jeep where he can just go anywhere back up in here.
Yeah.
And on the back of his Jeep, he had the sign, "Let's stop stream channelization." You see the hypocrisy of this type of thing. It's all for me. I want all of this just for me. I don't want anybody else there. There's an awfully lot of that in there. This kind of bothers me. We're looking for a scapegoat. Thoreau, living in, off where he did, writing this Walden Pond. Keep in mind that he had enough income that he could withdraw and go back there and live. Emerson, too. We've got to be realistic about these things. We cannot totally allow ourselves the luxury of feeling this way without also dealing with reality. We must deal with reality. We're deluding ourselves following that blindly. There is a lot of good material in there, but I deal with land. My area is agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with the College of Agriculture. I see so much pure emotionalism, pure and simple lack of understanding of what is really involved. No, that's my two points that I wanted to make.
Yeah. Oh, you're absolutely right. We cannot blindly follow this. And we must deal in realism. What I like about this book is that I didn't mention it, but there are some things toward the end which get down to more specific things which we can do. In an article that I've been reading from, which I had written for a newsletter, kind of as a politics of hope, I listed some very specific things that individuals can do. And I think, you know, if we talk about earth keeping, if we on a secular and sacred level, and don't follow up on it. We don't live out the grace of God, the redemptive quality that through Him we can do. Like you say, we're very hypocritical. Some of this practical things that we can do would be first to sensitize ourselves, to make ourselves aware. That's one level. Another is to say reduce our consumptive patterns, always searching for more, for better things, for higher technology. I think the word conservation, to conserve, to cut back a little bit on some comfort and extra things, is something that we can say through our lifestyle to others, that I realize that there is a big disparity between the level that I'm living at and the level that they're living at in Central America or Africa. And so by cutting back, we're helping to solve not only the problem of feeding our own poor here in this country, but perhaps on the road to being able to be good stewards of both nature and of people around the globe. I suggest do little things. Begin at home. Recycle your newspapers. Turn in aluminum cans. Even get money for that. There's even an incentive to do that. You walk along, pick up a little piece of trash along the way. And that's helping the environment. That's helping the visual environment. People walking by, they don't realize that someone before them has come and picked up the trash, but if you hadn't, they'd certainly notice that the place was trashy. Also avoid what they call the extrapolation to infinity, the idea that, although I'm just one person in this mass of humanity, and what can I do? I just, you know, the little things that I can do don't make a difference, so why should I even bother at all? I think even the little things that we do, it's the whole idea of the grassroots level, how that the little things that we do, our lifestyle, becomes a witness to others. And they say, you know, hey, that kind of makes sense. And branches out from there. Other people do it, and other people see that those people are doing it, and it spreads. Recycling and conservation of water spread throughout the whole city of San Francisco in just a short matter of a year, when they had a large problem with water. And not also not just to concentrate on the small things, but there are larger things, both through our vote and through speaking out, through writing to congressmen, sending poison pen letters to industry that has really bothered you, as far as say their smokestack emissions are killing the plants in your garden and ruining the paint job on your car or something. Even that's doing some of the larger things, and we can do those too. So
I'm going to have to go, because I'm reading at noon, and I'm going to get to my wedding.
All right.
Thank you.
But you are right. We must live in reality and do some of these things, act out, live the politics of hope.